When the historian's ideological bias distorts or ignores evidence from the past, a bad kind of revisionism emerges.
Dr. Mark Kaltoff of Hillsdale College, talking about his presentation at the Fall 2018 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
It masquerades as honest history. Such revisionism needs to be exposed and dismantled. It undermines proper understanding of our world. It has been said those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it. In this case, failure to expose bad revisionism means that those who do not know the past are condemned to suffer at the hands of biased ideologues who claim they do.
You can meet and hear Dr. Mark Kaltoff making the case against revisionist history at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference Friday, November 9th and Saturday, November 10th in Dallas, Texas. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385.
Good morning. I welcome everyone to this confirmation hearing on the nomination of
Mr.
Judge
Chairman
Brett Kavanaugh.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to be recognized to ask a question before we proceed. The committee received just last night, less than 15 hours ago, 42,000 pages of documents that we have not had an opportunity to review or read or analyze.
You're out of order. I'll proceed.
We cannot possibly move forward, Mr. Chairman.
I extend
this
a very warm welcome to
Judge
Kavanaugh.
We have not been given an opportunity to have a meaningful
his wife,
hearing
Ashley,
on the nominee.
There are two daughters.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with my colleague, Senator Harris. Mr. Chairman,
Judge
we received 42,000 documents that we haven't
and
been able
else joining
to review
us
last
today.
Night, and we believe this hearing should
I know
be postponed.
This is the American people.
Mr. Chairman, I move to adjourn.
To directly from Judge Kavanaugh later this afternoon.
Mr. Chairman, I move to adjourn.
Well, that's how 4 days of confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh began last week. It was high political theater. There's no doubt about it. It usually is. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live on this Monday afternoon, September the 10th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to be talking about the confirmation hearings, what happened there, high points, low points, and what happens going forward. Thomas Gipping of the Heritage Foundation will join us for the first few minutes of Issues Etc. A little bit later, our series on responding to Roman Catholic proof texts continues with Professor Stephen Parks. We're going to go into 2 Peter 3:15-16. Does this reference that Peter makes to the writings of Paul as difficult to understand, does that prove the obscurity of Scripture in general? Pastor Clint Poppy and Pastor Scott Adel will join us for the beginning of a brand new series on casuistry, that is, applying the Bible to the life of the church today. We'll be talking about the issue of cohabitation. A young couple approaches their pastor. They want to set a wedding date, and in the course of their conversation, he discovers they're already living together. They are cohabiting. What does he do? We will answer that question in an hour or two of Issues Etc. and all the questions that surround it. You can leave a question or a comment at our Facebook fan page as well on that very subject for Pastors Poppy and Adel as they join us in the second hour of the program, or just wait and give us a call, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MY-IE. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org, a tweet @issuesetc, or leave your question on that casuistic question of cohabitation at our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc, facebook.com/issuesetc. Joining us to discuss the recently closed confirmation hearings of Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, Thomas Gipping. He's deputy director of the Edwin Meese III Center for Legal and Judicial Studies and senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Tom, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, you spent several years as chief counsel for Senator Orrin Hatch, longstanding member of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Was there a moment that stood out to you the most during confirmation hearings for a Supreme Court nominee?
Well, I think it's not a moment that happened once, but it's the same moment that happened multiple times, and that is when particularly Democratic senators, although Republicans have done it sometimes as well, when senators really pushed a nominee to reveal what Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg once called hints, forecasts, or previews of how they were going to approach issues or decide cases in the future, and a nominee stood up to that. That was very important to me because there's nothing more important in a court setting than the judge's impartiality. And most Supreme Court nominees are already sitting judges, usually on the Court of Appeals, but also looking ahead to when they would serve on the Supreme Court, they're mindful of how important it is for them to be impartial. Politicians obviously don't have to be. So when senators, inappropriately, in my view, tried to find out how a nominee was going to rule on issues, in a sense, decide cases before they even saw them, Nominees said no. They drew a line in the sand and said, I'm not going to prejudge cases. I'm not going to make up my mind before I hear the arguments and consider the facts. So that's a very important moment, and it happened in every hearing. And thankfully, nominees consistently said that their being impartial was more important to them than the senator's politics.
To your mind, is that an attempt on the senator's part to really get information, or to simply wrap the nominee around the axle, or perhaps even set up a case for that nominee recusing themselves if they serve on the court?
Well, I don't think it's setting up a case where they recuse themselves. I think many senators, I think many of our fellow citizens, think of the courts in general and the Supreme Court in particular as a political institution, that the only thing that really matters is how a judge rules, which side wins, which issue or which political interest is furthered. So that's all they want to know. They either believe that judges decide cases based on their personal views, and so they're going to ask about those personal views, or they'll be a little less subtle and they'll say, whose side are you going to be on in certain kinds of cases, or they'll use other tactics, but that's really what they're after. That's a very political way of looking at the judiciary. I'm always glad to see it when judges decline to go down that road.
So what was the high point of the confirmation hearings for Judge Brett Kavanaugh for you?
Well, I think it might have been defending that same principle. He was also a little bit more focused on certain elements of what we sometimes call judicial philosophy. That is, he was asked about what originalism is, what textualism is. He was more concrete in saying that it is the text of the law that is the law. Obviously, there was more theatrics going on, both from senators on the committee and from audience members. And I think that was unfortunate because it really undermined the opportunity that a confirmation hearing like this plays and presents for people to learn more about the judiciary. I think people know least about the judicial branch than they do the other ones. When senators asked that kind of a question, when they really were trying to get at and or get Brett Kavanaugh to abandon his impartiality, he refused to do so, and that's very important.
What about the low point?
The low point of the hearing was the fact that every Democrat on the committee had announced his or her opposition to Brett Kavanaugh weeks and weeks ago. So, you know, the bulk of time that was spent talking about and fighting about, we need more time, we need more documents, we don't know this, we don't know that, which took up perhaps half the time of the entire hearing, that was all a charade, because the senators saying they needed more information didn't need any of that information when they made up their minds, some of them almost 2 weeks before Kavanaugh's nomination was even announced. I think Republicans perhaps should have pointed that out even more often than they did, because it really put in perspective a lot of what was going on. That was really misleading. It was deceptive, and it suggested that really a lot of those conflicts weren't about that hearing and that nominee at all. I think there's a lot of questions and arguments that were really using Brett Kavanaugh as a proxy for President Trump, and that's really not what a confirmation hearing is supposed to be about.
Why were pro-choice leaders upset when Judge Kavanaugh referred to some forms of birth control as abortion-inducing drugs?
Well, he did not refer to certain forms of birth control as abortion-inducing drugs. He was characterizing the argument of parties in a case as having argued that. That said, pro-abortion advocates bristle at any suggestion that abortion has any sort of negative effect on a human being. They want to avoid any suggestion that there's any kind of birth control that's untoward or negative in some way. But of course, the distinction for many people between two forms of birth control, that is, birth control that prevents conception and birth control that kills the product of conception, is a very important distinction. But Judge Kavanaugh was not expressing his own view about that. He was describing the position that a parties in a case had taken.
Do you think that the confirmation hearings for Brett Kavanaugh changed the minds of any of our senators?
No. Most, if not all, senators have already decided how they're going to vote. And it's kind of conventional wisdom that you can't necessarily achieve confirmation in a hearing, but you can lose it. That is, if there's some kind of a terrible disaster, you know, in the hearing, which there clearly wasn't. But I think most, if not all, senators have already decided how they're going to vote. Certainly the senators on the Judiciary Committee did, and there was virtually no chance that anything that could happen in the hearing would have an impact on their decision. And I think, therefore, the participants in the hearing were really using that hearing for other purposes, either to speak to their own political base, to try to clarify maybe some issues that the public needed to learn more about, perhaps say something that they hoped the media might report on, but there weren't any undecided minds in that hearing room.
Thomas Gipping is our guest, Deputy Director of the Edwin Meese III Center for Legal and Judicial Studies, Senior Legal Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. When we come back, how does the confirmation process go forward now?
Based upon human dignity, the nature of a human person, that we protect certain human rights.
Dr. Ryan Anderson of the Heritage Foundation talking about his presentation at the Fall 2018 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
And then amongst these human rights, the very first one is going to be the right to life, and then the right to liberty, especially religious liberty, and then how freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom of assembly and association, how these things actually hang together or they fall together. That a society that doesn't respect the free exercise of religion also will tend not to respect freedom of speech or freedom of press or the right to life or rights of private property, that these civil liberties tend to hang together.
You can meet and hear Ryan Anderson making the case for our first freedoms at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, November 9th and Saturday, November 10th in Dallas, Texas. Find out more and register at issuesetc.org.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Remember when education was about the fundamental skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic? And about reading great literature and studying history to give our kids a model for what it is to be a good person? Memoria Press's classical Christian curriculum offers that very model for your homeschool. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR17. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, a classical Christian education that works.
We would like to overlook the difficulty of daily repentance and death to our sins in the interest of progressing to a more advanced spirituality.
Rebecca Curtis from her new audiobook, Ladylike, Living Biblically.
Somehow, spiritual advancement always amounts to our getting to spend more time on the things we like and calling it stewardship or service.
You can purchase and download an audio version of Ladylike, Living Biblically at Amazon, Audible, and iTunes. Ladylike, Living Biblically by Rebecca Curtis and Rose Adel. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the confirmation hearings of Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh this Monday afternoon. Thomas Gipping of the Heritage Foundation is our guest. So, Thomas, how does the confirmation process go forward now?
Well, the nomination obviously is in the Judiciary Committee right now. As soon as President Trump made the nomination on July 9th, it was referred to the Judiciary Committee. So just like anything, any bill or anything else that gets referred to the committee has to vote on it. They have to decide whether to send the nomination to the full Senate. That will take place at the committee's next business meeting, which takes place typically on Thursdays. I think Thursday the 13th of September will be the next one, but I think it will probably be delayed until Thursday the 20th. I think the vote will be along party lines to report the nomination to the full Senate, so that the week of September 24th, the full Senate will debate and vote on the nomination, and I believe that it will be confirmed by the end of that week, and he will receive at least a few Democratic votes.
What votes do you think those are going to be that will break with the party line from the General Senate?
Well, there haven't been really any more than a handful of senators, a couple of Republicans, three or four Democrats all along who were sort of in the questionable category. I personally don't think that either Senator Susan Collins of Maine or Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, those are two Republicans, that they were ever in doubt. I think they started from a posture of wanting to support a Republican, a really well-qualified Republican nominee. But you have senators in states that President Trump won by large margins in 2016 who themselves are up for re-election this year. Joe Manchin of West Virginia, Joe Donnelly of Indiana, Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota in particular. And every indication since the nomination has been that they've attempted to keep an open mind. They've responded positively to Judge Kavanaugh's obvious, really superior qualifications. There were some reporters asked them whether anything that, you know, was discussed in the hearing, you know, caused them to be concerned, and they didn't indicate that they were. So I think the basic common sense arguments about qualifications, and those senators, by the way, supported Justice Neil Gorsuch a year ago as well. So I'd be surprised if you didn't have about a 54-46 vote when all is said and done.
When did Supreme Court confirmation hearings become the political theater that they are today?
Well, I think the break came just as a practical matter in 1987. 1986, I was working for then Judge Antonin Scalia on the U.S. Court of Appeals, and then he was nominated to the Supreme Court that year. He was confirmed 98-0. Well, Republicans lost the Senate in 1986. The next year, President Reagan nominated Robert Bork to the Supreme Court. And that's when the lines were really more sharply drawn, and Democrats and liberal outside interests were much more organized in terms of opposing judges who took a traditional view toward interpreting the Constitution. Bork obviously was defeated that year. Most of the Supreme Court nominations since then have been extremely difficult. A few have been relatively non-controversial, but most of them have been very divisive and really very confrontational.
They are, of course, set in the context of a 24-hour news cycle, and then also they are broadcast live. They're big news. If the TV cameras were not in the committee room, do you think that they would be what they are today?
No, I don't. And of course, media, for better or worse, have a somewhat distorting effect on a lot of things. That things that are relatively minor appear to be very significant, and vice versa. The hearing that we just saw, after all, was only 4 days, and the entire confirmation process from nomination to confirmation will probably be about 80 days. So really, in the big scheme of things, a 4-day hearing is just a teeny little slice of all of the different things that contribute to evaluating this nominee. But as you say, this is that's the one portion of it that is covered extensively, particularly by television. And it's also the part of the process that is the most sort of choreographed and organized and orchestrated in terms of political interests, the protesters that you saw from, you know, in the audience. I think that was all sort of pre-planned. The kinds of questions and attack points that senators were using. So those factors contribute to really highlight it, but it really is a fairly minor part of the process. In fact, the practice we see today of nominees interacting with the committee at their hearing only started in the 1950s or 60s. And people have a short attention span, so if people paid attention and learned anything, they probably have forgotten it by now. But we're almost finished with the process. The most important part of it, obviously, are the votes that senators cast.
Is it a necessary part, the broadcasted Senate Judiciary Committee hearings? Is that a necessary part of the confirmation process?
Well, it's certainly not legally required. Senate rules, since probably about the middle of the 19th century, Senate rules have said that, you know, nominations get referred to the appropriate committees depending on their subject matter, but that doesn't dictate how the committees themselves have to treat the nominee or the steps that they take. And as I say, the Judiciary Committee never held a Supreme Court confirmation hearing at all before 1916, and even then, the nominee didn't appear. And it was decades until that started happening as a practice. The committee can do its job of evaluating and reporting and recommending to the Senate any way that it wants, and it does not have to do it with a really highly charged televised hearing.
Is this pretty much what we're in for, depending on the circumstances of the future, should President Trump have an opportunity to nominate another justice for the Supreme Court? Are we pretty much going to see this all played out again?
Well, as long as a significant portion of the electorate and of our elected representatives hold to a very politicized view of the judiciary, so long as there is this huge conflict between the impartial model of judging that I think America's founders designed and the very political approach that today's liberals want, as long as that clash goes on, this is exactly what we're going to see. I mean, there isn't supposed to be this much at stake in the appointment of some individual judges. I mean, America's founders, after all, said the judiciary would be the least dangerous and the weakest branch, and we're treating it today as if it's the opposite. So there is, for certainly the liberal end of the political spectrum, for the Democratic Party in the Senate, there is a lot at stake, and therefore they're going to act accordingly. I would hope if there was a way to return to a broader consensus for the kind of judiciary that America's founders designed, then we would probably see this correspondingly less in terms of division in media attention. But until then, this is what we're going to see.
So in a nutshell, how would you correct that notion that the Supreme Court is an innately political body, that the justices there not only could but should be rendering their decisions based upon their personal views? How would you correct that?
The American people have to either learn for the first time or relearn the particulars of our political system and the way our system was designed. I mean, we used to call it civics, but that needs to be taught. I mean, you can't evaluate the performance of anyone in any job unless you have a clear idea of what their job description is and about the job they're supposed to do. The system that we have and the judiciary's role in it didn't happen by accident. It happened by design. And we need to do a better job of educating our fellow citizens of what that design is. And people need to think about what it really means when the one unelected branch of government is given this much power. In a system like ours, the people have the political power, and they entrust some of that to their elected representatives. We don't elect federal judges, and it doesn't make sense to put them in charge of the meaning of the Constitution and of our laws when we don't even have a say in them getting elected. So it all starts with a better knowledge of how our system of government is supposed to work.
Thomas Gipping is Deputy Director for the Edwin Meese III Center for Legal and Judicial Studies and Senior Legal Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. You'll find a link to the Heritage Foundation at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Tom, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can meet and hear Tom Gipping's colleague at the Heritage Foundation, Dr. Ryan Anderson, making the case for our first freedoms at the Fall 2018 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Dallas, Texas. We are 2 months away. We are currently more than half full. Attendance is limited to 400. Childcare is free thanks to Wittenberg Academy. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385. It's Making the Case Conference Friday, November 9th and Saturday, November 10th in Dallas, Texas. When we come back, we're going to spend some time with Professor Stephen Parks. Our series with him continues, part 12 of our series, Responding to Roman Catholic Proof Text. Today, does Peter, when he writes about the writings of Paul, saying they are sometimes difficult to understand, they're in 2 Peter chapter 3, does that prove the obscurity of Scripture? We'll answer that question with Professor Stephen Parks after the break. Then in Hour 2 of Issues Etc., we begin a series on casuistry, applying the Bible to the life of the church. We'll talk about cohabitation.
There are nearly 20 million college students in the United States. 40% will stop going to church during college. 50% will never return. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is seeking to meet this challenge through LCMSU. Why? Because 100% of college students matter to God and to His church. College is tough. You need Jesus. We'll help. LCMSU. Check us out at lcms.org/lcmsu.
The Church's Music from the 20th Century. The 17th Century. The 11th Century. Eighth Century. The Fourth Century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Concordia University Chicago is a distinctive, comprehensive university of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. We're committed to increasing LCMS faculty and staff members. This is Dr. Daniel Gard, president of Concordia University Chicago. If you are a member of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod with excellent professional credentials, please consider applying for our faculty or staff family. Current openings are posted at cuchicago.edu/HR.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Are you tired of working out at big box gyms? You'll find quality personal training and qualified instruction at Performance Fitness in Edwardsville. You can even work out for a full 30 days before making a commitment to join. Find out more at performancefitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness is the facility in the St. Louis Metro East where the focus is on member results, not membership numbers. Performance Fitness 618.com.
I'm Pastor Todd Rappe. I serve a congregation here in Fayetteville, North Carolina, Our Redeemer Lutheran Church, a sister congregation of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. All of the saints here gather around blood, water, and spirit as theologians of the cross every Sunday morning at 10:30. We only welcome sinners. We certainly would welcome you. If you'd like to contact us through our website, you may do so at faylcms.org.